Welcome to the Resilience Rising podcast with me, your host, Jen Scottney. With the help of my guests, we will be getting curious about what resilience is, how we develop it, and the times we've used it. This podcast is here to explore all things resilience. On the podcast today is Leonie Charlton. Leonie lives in Glenlone in Argyll, where she and her husband Martin are tenants of an organically run hill farm. They live alongside their many animals and have three grown-up children who come and go. Leonie is a writer and is passionate about our relationship as a human animal with the rest of the natural world. She is the author of Marram, a travel memoir of a trip riding with Highland ponies through the Outer Hebrides, and also a poetry pamphlet, 10 Minutes of Weather Away. She is currently doing a PhD through the University of the Highlands and Islands, looking at Scotland's deer question, and aims to give voice, as best as she can, to the many parties involved, including the more than human, through creative writing. Welcome to the podcast, Leonie. It's so good to finally get to chat to you.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for your book, Marram, which I absolutely loved. Thank you. It's felt really poignant just reading it just as I'm about to pack up and move to Scotland as well. I describe Marram as a travel memoir there, but I just found it so much more. It's just such a beautiful story, like a journey of growth and letting go and healing history, nature, landscapes, and also just this power of people and horses. There was just so much in it, Leonie. So I just wondered, where did that come from? Like, how did this book come into being?
Well, thank you for that positivity. I'm glad it landed well with you. So I didn't set out to write that book. I was working on a novel at the time that I have yet to finish, but it's still there in the pipeline.
And we're going back about 10 years, are we, Leo?
Yes, time. You know, people spend 20, 30 years getting their first novel written. I've completely let go of all expectations around it. But Marram was a surprise. So I have done a few long trips with the ponies with Shuna, who is my travel companion in the book. And we had this trip through the Hebrides planned, and it coincided with being about 7 years after my mother died. And just before we set off, I had a long chat with my dear friend, she's Catalan, and she is a great believer in ritual. And I don't really have any ritual in my life. I'm non-religious, although I do think of myself as an animist or a panpsychist, but I don't have a structured religion, and I have very little ritual in my life. And she's a big follower of someone called Jodorowsky, who he makes films and is, I don't quite know how to describe him, but he's a sort of extraordinary psychologist person, and he really believes in the power of ritual. And I was talking to Gloria, I don't know what's wrong with me. Mum died 7 years ago. It's getting worse. The grief is getting worse. It just doubles me up. What can I do? And she lost her mum at a similar time. And she said, have you thought about some kind of ritual? Like, you know, doing something physical to help sort through things. And I went away and I thought about it. And it just came to me. You know, that's how things just come to you sometimes. I thought, mum was a jeweler and she collected beads from all over the world. And she has this incredible collection. We have it now. And I went and chose a little bundle of beads that spoke to me. And I'll say at this point, they're all glass. They're all natural. You know, there's no plastic or anything that's going to pollute the environment. And I took this little purse of beads and I thought, what I'd like to do is connect with mum every day somewhere where I felt close to her and leave a bead for her. and just see what happened. And she loved the Outer Hebrides. And it just became an incredibly powerful part of the journey for me, and wholly unexpected. And I feel it changed me, and it really changed my relationship with Mom, which is ongoing. So, you know, now she died in 2010. We're 14 years on, and I still feel like I'm very much in relationship with Mom, and it's a live relationship, if that makes sense. It's ever evolving.
It does. And in an earlier episode, when I talked about grief with Lizzie Pickering, she talked about how those connections of relationship in our brain are still there and ongoing, no matter if we've lost the person that we're in that relationship with. It's alive, those patterns, and can take a lifetime. Or, you know, maybe we never accept that person isn't there. And you talk, so that was the journey. I was at that point, did you realise that it was going to be a book? Because it didn't feel like that. I suppose sometimes I'm, you know, I read books about that, it feels like they went to look for something to write about, but it really didn't feel like that with your book. It felt like you had this journey, and the book came later.
Absolutely. So I always travel with notebooks. I've got millions of these little pocket-sized notebooks, and generally, I mean, I've been writing in them for years and years and years and years, and generally I never go back to them. They're just there. I don't know what they're waiting for, but anyway, they're there and they're...
They're waiting for us to read them, Leonie. I want to read them.
And I... Well, maybe something will come of them one day. But this little notebook I got home from the trip. It was an extraordinary trip, like 3 weeks through the Hebrides with the ponies and Shuna and, and all the people we met. It was extraordinary. Mm. And the notebook was burning a hole in my metaphorical pocket by then. And I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And very quickly after I got home, I started writing it. I just thought, I need to put everything else to one side and I need to focus on this. And I am a really slow worker in just about every respect. And Marim, I wrote over a winter, which is really unusual for me, but it just wanted to be, I don't know if it wanted to be written, but I certainly wanted to write it, and it came easily. Not that it was always an easy write, you know, it took me on quite, as you'll appreciate, writing can be quite a deep inquiry, and it took me down into some dark places at times. But yeah, a joy to relive the trip and explore some of the things that came up during that time.
And do you see the writing as very much part of the process of the grieving? It's something that was helping you on that process, rather than, well, I had this journey and now I need to write about it just to record it. It's felt like, well, for me, that the writing process is another stage in that processing.
Yeah, hugely, Jen. As you say that, I can feel myself tearing up. It's like, that is so true. It is absolutely so true. It's the writing, and it's not about there being a readable output. The writing itself is such a deep and important process for me. And it still is. You know, I do writing inquiries all the time. I just sit and do free writing and see what comes. Or if I'm struggling with something, I mean, my first thing is I go for a walk. I always walk with issues, and then I write. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you discover so much as you write. I discovered so much about my mum, the trip, my relationship with Shuna, my relationship with the horses, my relationship with place, and how place responds, how place responds in turn to us. So I'm very interested in the idea of reciprocal relationships. You know, we're not walking through a place and enjoying it. It's what is the relationship? What happens when you listen? What do you hear? What can you give back? I'm very, very interested in that.
Yeah,
the past few hundred years, certainly generally speaking, in the Western world, it's been a bit of a sorry state of affairs in terms of dualism and separating ourselves from the rest of the natural world. And it's become very extractive, again, generally speaking. But I think the tide is turning. It feels like the tide is turning. And people are longing for a more reciprocal relationship again.
Yes, I loved how refreshing your book felt. And I'm sure we'll talk about this, but also that the slowness, I think I said to you before, it was so nice to have a book where it wasn't about the end achievement goal. I'm going to get there as fast as possible or be the first to get there. It really felt like you savoured your time. And that meant that those relationships and that reciprocal relationship back were more nurtured. I mean, even though it was only 3 weeks, it just felt like it was a slow journey.
Absolutely. And thanks for bringing that up. And I love that you love that. I've spent years feeling quite a lot of shame around my slowness. I remember doing an endurance ride, the first endurance ride many years ago. I haven't got a competitive bone in my body, but anyway, I went along to join in, and you know, we were completely out of time. And I remember sharing it with someone afterwards, and they said we could have walked it faster. And I remember bursting into tears. I was so upset. And now I look at it actually with affection and pride. It's like, why not go slowly? It's wonderful to go slowly. And you know, I'm in my early 50s now, and I love being in my 50s. I'm excited about it. And I'm just giving myself permission to be as slow as I want. And if you look at, I mean, trees, you know, and trees and horses in particular, they live in the long tide. They're not worried about what time it is or how many days something takes or what the destination is or the height or the meters climbed. Or I find really, really inspiring and really, really important. And it's becoming one of my core values, I think, to go at the pace that feels right for me and the beings around me.
I feel like it's something that I was forced to accept with my injuries and chronic illnesses. And before then, it wasn't something that I relished. And when I couldn't go the furthest and the fastest and the most sleep deprived, when I ran across the country in like a few days. And I really felt like, well, who's interested in what I'm doing now? Because yes, I wasn't really seeing those stories so much. And that was probably more that I wasn't looking for them rather than they weren't there. But it's now forced me to just go slow and appreciate the details and find the joy in just these wonderful moments that I could have easily run past and missed before, particularly the human interactions that you had. If you were aiming to do the fastest crossing of the Outer Hebrides on a horse, you wouldn't have stayed anywhere and met those people. So for me, I think it was, yeah, it's something that I've been forced to appreciate, but I appreciate it so much now and really see that sometimes that fastest and the furthest and the big achievements aren't even healthy for us anyway.
Yeah, and it's also not an either or, it's an and both. And I have huge respect. I mean, total respect for people. You know, when I'm out in the hills, I'll see people running past me and I am completely blown away by them. Like the strength of your minds and your bodies and your endurance and your resilience. I mean, that is kind of exciting and exquisite and totally amazing. So I'm not in any way saying that it's better to go slow. It's just it's great to remember both. I've never been fast. So my heart goes out to you. It must have been an agony being, you know, forcibly torn away from that ability to go fast. I often wonder what it must feel like to run in the hills. It must be incredible. And there are other ways, as you're finding.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, I really feel
But if I hadn't have had that, then I wouldn't be sat here talking to you and going down the path that I have gone down. So I'm learning to appreciate that as well.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to see that. I had something similar when my back, I destroyed my back, really, and ended up having surgery. And at the time, it forcibly stopped me doing a career that I adored, which was trimming horses' feet. I was an equine podiatrist. I loved it. It encompassed people, horses, and sort of like sculpture, really. And I loved it. And then I couldn't do it anymore. And I was heartbroken. But because I stopped doing that, I came to the writing. And I probably wouldn't have if I was still trimming. So I have absolute faith that, well, look at what you're doing with this new space.
And going back.
Yeah, it's great what you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much, Leonie. And just going back to that period when you mentioned about your back, I think you brought this up quite early in the book and seemed to think there was a link between that and your mother's death. And I think at the time you said also that you mentioned having like a mental and physical breakdown. And I know that we both have that interest in the blurred lines between the mental and the physical health. I just wondered, like, what was that looking like for you? And I guess, do you see that as part of the grieving process and the grief as well?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really believe that everything is connected. And particularly our bodies are, they hold so much knowledge, and they hold so much trauma, and they hold so much joy. And if we listen to what they're saying to us, it opens up the universe, really. So I think we can very effectively shut things down with our mind. So mum had a brain tumor, and there was a year of her dying very slowly, in a really upsetting way. So she lost her ability to speak, but she was fully compos mentis. Now I had a very difficult relationship with mum, and there were a lot of defenses, and I absolutely felt like I fell in love with her in that last year. I fell in love with her again, shall we say, but we couldn't communicate. She couldn't speak. I mean, I could do my best, but it was clumsy, and it was heartbreaking. And she died, and I somehow thought it might get easier, but it really didn't. And then as I was carrying on working, and I had this chronic back pain, and I was just pushing through, and I hadn't really allowed myself to stop and grieve. And I certainly hadn't given myself time to really understand our relationship. And then one day I was up near Malaig trimming, and I felt this ice spread through my back, and my discs had burst, basically. And then I had a year of not being able to do anything, trying to recover. And it was like my body was like, you have to stop and you have to look at this stuff. You can't just keep powering on and being defensive, and you know, these hard edges we can put up around our heart. It was like I just had a complete, everything broke down. My back broke down, my mind broke down, my body broke down, and I couldn't cope. And I was also on really hardcore painkillers, and I don't think they helped, but I just needed to hit rock bottom in order to get real. And I heard a psychologist on the radio the other day talking about young people's mental health problems, and she was saying young people today have it so hard, and that the ability to sit with discomfort and pain has been taken away from them by social media. You know, there's all, everything's, they've got stuff coming in all the time. rather than that ability to sit still and really feel pain. It's a normal part of life, but social media would suggest it's not, and we all have to be okay all the time. And there's tremendous shame around it. You know, I remember saying to my dad one day, who's a very lovely man, but saying, he said, "How are you?" I said, "I'm not good." And he literally just walked away. And I'm not judgmental of him, but it was just that people are really deeply uncomfortable with vulnerability, with other people's pain sometimes. And I think it's so important to be able to sit comfortably with other people's pain and your own. So yeah, my back absolutely was a symptom of heartbreak, and not just heartbreak, you know, quite toxic emotions like anger, resentment, a lifetime of anger, resentment, that now I see so differently, like one of the beautiful things about getting older. And of course, it's not exclusive to older people, but as you get older, it's nice. The lens widens, and there's so many more possibilities. So I look at my relationship with mum now. I look at her and I look at how she was, and I see things so differently, so differently. If you can just step back from the immediacy of a situation. And of course, that's quite sad. It comes with its own pain, because I just want another, you know, basically I want another go. And I can't have that.
Yes. Yeah. And you said about hitting rock bottom, and then obviously you've been through this process over years, and physically and mentally in a much different place. And I just wondered how did you get through that? What do you attribute it to, that getting out of rock bottom?
Yeah. So my relationship with the more than human has always been, you know, since my earliest memories, incredibly important to me. And it was, I heard someone recently talk about, a lot of us are familiar with attachment styles. So we form these attachment styles in our very early lives with people, usually with our mother, our parent figure. And from whatever happens in those early months, this is simplifying it horribly, but you move on to have an avoidant or a secure or an anxious attachment style, or a combination of all. And I would say I have an anxious attachment style in my human relationships. But this person, and I can't remember who she was talking about how you can have those attachment styles with people, but it doesn't mean you can't have secure attachment styles with other things in your life. And I just had a real light bulb moment of, oh my goodness, that's it. All my life, I have had a really secure relationship with the natural world, with animals, with plants, with hills, with rivers, with rain. That's just been an absolute certainty, 100% knowing. And whenever I've struggled and I go out walking or riding or just sitting by a river, whatever, you know, it's the quiet listening, and you get the help. It's like, yeah, it's happened to me all my life. I get the support and help I need from listening to the more than human world. And I know it sounds cliched, and it's so true, and I'm passionate about it. And that's my relationship. Yeah, that's my relationship. Yeah, I would say that's the number one thing. And then, of course, people. But my relationship with the natural world gives me that grounding, that safe space.
I'm sure a lot of people will resonate with that, just the natural world and how grounding and what a support it is. But I've never heard it talked about in that relationship style. So thank you for bringing that up. And I guess your writing, we already talked about how important that was.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And all relationships, my relationship with the natural world around me, which I feel very much a part of, is constantly evolving. a real turning point for me, I think, was reading Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass. I don't know. Have you come across that?
Yes, I have.
And she, you know, she talks so eloquently about this reciprocal relationship between human animals and the rest of the natural world. And it landed so well with me. And there's so much negativity. We have behaved so badly. We, again, in the Western world, generally speaking, have behaved so badly the past couple of hundred years. And it doesn't mean that there's not tremendous capacity for connecting and living in a reciprocal relationship with the rest of the natural world, which, of course, is ever increasingly important with the climate and biodiversity crises. It's really, really rising up. It's there in public consciousness in a big way now.
And is this something that you've moved on to do your PhD on? I mentioned about the deer question coming up in that, and I wondered if this is something that sounds quite relevant to what your PhD is on.
Yeah, it's funny. So the PhD, here I am doing a PhD looking at the so-called deer question in Scotland, which is the intersection between culture, trees, deer, land management, politics. So much comes into it. The tension basically between numbers of deer on the ground and what different people want. And I'm looking at it from using creative writing to hopefully give voice to as many different parties involved, and including the more than human. Now, this is problematic. It's problematic enough trying to fairly and responsibly give voice to another human, and we all know how much is lost in translation. And then if you extend that to the more than human, it's really challenging. But I am so excited about it, and I think it's an area that is missing in a lot of policy conversation. Like, it's not only the people. Mm. It's all the beings working together. Deer have always been there for me, and as a really important presence. And now here I am really inquiring into the situation. And what I'm seeing is they're the ultimate animal of resilience. They, you know, in Britain today, one in six species is on the verge of extinction. Meanwhile, deer are, you know, the populations are exploding, which is causing all sorts of problems. But the deer themselves are these incredibly resilient animals capable of living in different places, in the edgelands. Their resilience is extraordinary. Yeah, I was thinking about the etymology of the word resilient, which is the Latin resiliere, which is actually to rebound and springing back. And I was like, oh my goodness, you know, what a verb for deer, rebound and springing back. And they're just so quick to respond to changes in whatever capacity. And I think we could learn a lot from deer. I mean, we do have this conflict where policy is advising, and there is a need, I believe, to control the deer numbers. Again, control is a difficult word, but because they are doing so well and there are so many of them, and they eat trees and we want trees, it's all very complex. But I think we can learn a lot from deer, and I don't think we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. We've had, you know, our relationship with deer goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And nowadays, in many circles, they've been called vermin. You know, they've gone from the mythical creature to vermin. And it's really sad. And I think it's important to look at narrative and both is possible. They're not either or. They're not vermin. They're not. Yeah, it's complex.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think we were talking earlier. This is an area where I feel like I'm not well informed, and it is a complex, and I do want to understand more. But maybe the more I read and the more I look at it, the more complex it's going to seem. But yeah, just that language around it, that control, and do you feel like we like the binary? It's nice and comforting to have the black and the white and not sit in the grey. And is this, I mean, I'm thinking also of those themes that we've talked about earlier in your book. And yeah, so are we too quick to try and put it into one side or the other and not sit in the messiness, I guess?
Absolutely. I think we, society, capitalism, patriarchy has encouraged binary thinking, binary systems, and the natural world does not, you know, the natural world, including us, is so complex, and it doesn't fall into binaries, and we just come up against problems. I've had an experience in my personal life which has really plunged me deeply into this non-binary and uncertainty place, which is, I haven't actually spoken about this before. So it's that Shuna, who I travel with, I actually fell in love with Shuna. We fell in love with each other. So, you know, I am a married heterosexual woman. I fell in love with my best friend. Huge questions, where do you sit with that? Huge messiness. How does that work? There isn't a language. There isn't a model. Yeah, so it's kind of the ultimate of, oh, okay, so I tried for a very long time to put it into boxes. It doesn't work. It didn't work. And it led me into a renewed sense of appreciation around complexity and messiness and this idea of and both and multiple truths.
And I feel like that also...
It's big stuff.
It is big stuff. I was just going to talk about the relationship with your mother as well. There were so many multiple truths that you were unraveling. And also in the book, you talk about briefly about other loss. You talked about a suicide of your mother's partner and a miscarriage that you had and the loss of that baby. And I just wondered, thinking of that bouncing back idea of resilience, that springing back, I feel like for me, that doesn't work with grief and loss. I'm not looking to spring back. And I just wondered, I think for me, though, that has been problematic in that you want to, when I've had bereavements, it's like, okay, well, I need to get through that and get back to how it was. And it's been such a lesson for me in that not happening, that life isn't going to go back to how it was and just spring back. And I just wondered, is there a different resilience that works for you for that loss and grief?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that idea of springing back. And it's great to hear you say, you know, you don't want to spring back. It's not, we can't go back to where we were before. It's absolutely impossible. It's about encompassing and broadening and maturing and learning. And, you know, parts of us will be forever changed in quite deformed ways, if you like physically, you know, like I've got a very operated on back. You know, you know about surgery. You'll never be untouched by those scalpels.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't necessarily want to be, you know, can we inhabit these changes with grace and with compassion and with open-mindedness? I did lose I lost a baby in pregnancy, and my stepfather hanged himself at the same time. And it was a time of, it was horrific, absolutely horrific. And I think, you know, probably looking back then, it was a long time ago, there was a sense of not sitting with that pain, not really listening, not really giving it the gravitas it needed. You just go back to work the next day. And, you know, our bodies have a way of storing stuff and saving them up and then saying, here you go. Now you're ready. Deal with it. Now you're ready. Have a look at this. What do you think? How can you kind of make the world better? Sounds very grand. But just how can you be more authentic in a way that helps other people? I think honesty and authenticity is so important. And we have our limits. Like, we're not always ready to talk about stuff, certainly not in the public sphere. I don't know if that answers your question, Jen.
I love the words grace and compassion and openness in terms of resilience. And it also feels like you value just that stopping and stillness and reflection, and whether you're forced to or not, as being part of the resilience as well. Whereas for me, when my dad and my brother died really close together, and I did just go back to work the next day and outwardly looked very resilient, I'm sure. But for me now, that isn't what I think resilience is. It's about being able to sit with those big thoughts, to have those big conversations, and that openness that you're just sharing now and showing us.
Yeah, Jen. I mean, I think our capacity for pain is equal to our capacity for love and joy. And I think the two are absolutely essential. And, you know, what better way of honoring someone you've loved than deeply, deeply grieving them?
And then how was it putting those personal feelings, thoughts, experiences onto a page for other people to read? It sounded like your writing was so personal. And yes, I just wondered how the process was of then putting it out there for people, which you did with Marim.
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't think about it a great deal. I mean, there were certainly things I didn't include. As I've just alluded to, my relationship with Shuna. But there was a lot that was very personal indeed. And when I didn't think about it, it was just important to me to do as good a job as possible of being authentic and honest. If you start worrying about what other people are going to think, it's really crippling. Mm. But that's not to say once it was out there, I didn't have those thoughts. And it's funny, there's a couple of voices, and I won't say who they are, but they're kind of very well-known writers who I admire tremendously. And they kind of became this awful negative voice in my head, like, what would they be saying about this? And, you know, I would almost obsess about it. And I thankfully I've moved through that. It's like, you know what, we can't please everyone. And, you know, you just do what feels right for you. And you hope that that might resonate and impact with someone else. But the minute you start trying to write for a certain audience it's just hopeless. But yeah, I was lucky. I just never thought it would be published. So that as I was writing it, that was just not there. I just wrote. And then, yeah, I sent it out. And then it did. And there have been a few wobbly moments. But on the whole, it's been an incredibly affirming and positive experience. And people have been really kind and generous about it. And that's not to say I'm sure that, you know, some people haven't been, but I haven't heard them. You know, my imagination can work it out, but I try not to go down that path. I don't know. Have you come across Byron Katie at all?
No.
Byron Katie? She's an American. She has a system of self-inquiry. And one of her questions is she works a lot on relationship. She's really worth listening to. And her book, I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, she has a question. Is it really? So often we have these imaginary narratives. Like we imagine, we think we know what someone's thinking. And one of her questions is it true? You know, identify your belief and go, is it true? And then how do you know it's true? And I love that question so much, because 99% of the time we've got this little story about someone else and we think they think this about us. We have got no evidence of that. And really, unless you ask someone, and even then they might not tell the truth, but unless you ask someone and hear it from their mouth, we're in the dark. And I find that so liberating and so helpful. Is it true? Is it really true?
Yes. I've definitely asked that before. It came up with a yoga nidra teacher, actually, who had a similar questioning. And I put it in some writing that I did on acceptance, because I found that I was trying to accept things that I didn't need to accept because they weren't even true. So, yes, I find that really helpful.
It's so fascinating. We are the story-making animal, which is rather wonderful, isn't it? It's beautiful. And it can get us into so much trouble, particularly in our human-to-human relationships.
Mm.
In a way, even with animals, actually, we can have stories about them. And it's worth challenging that all the time.
And I suppose that theme...
Isn't it? Yeah. It's fun embracing the unspoken.
And finding out the person standing in our way is always ourselves.
Yeah. Another thing that Byron Katie does is, you know, you turn the question around. So-and-so says this, and you turn it around saying, I say this. And it's like, oh, my goodness. You know, what is my response, my reaction to them showing me about me? It's so interesting and not always comfortable.
No, and it felt like going back to that relationship with your mum that went through the book, and it just felt so hard that obviously she died and you'd been left with these feelings and there was no way that you could have a conversation with her to resolve anything. So all that resolution had to come from yourself, and I think that questioning of what was true and what you had been believing and trying to accept seem like such a central theme in the book, and one that you put down so openly and beautifully in it.
Well, thank you. I mean, it really was, as my back was crumbling and as my mental health was crumbling, all these very carefully constructed narratives I had about my mum were crumbling. Mm. They just disappeared to dust. I suddenly realized no substance, and I'd been living my life with them, around them, reacting to them. It's devastating. And, you know, it's been an amazing learning, and I hope that my relationship's now benefiting from that awareness. It's sad, isn't it? Sometimes the hard routes we have to go to learn.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was thinking when you were talking about giving voice to the non-humans, and it felt like you had such a close bond with your horse on this journey. And I felt like I was seeing the journey through your horse's eyes in some of the chapters. And I mean, I'm not somebody who's grown up around horses, and although I do love animals and have a dog that I think I can see feel what he's thinking most of the time. But yeah, how special was that bond, and what's that brought you?
Yeah, I mean, I barely have the words to say how special that is. The privilege of sharing time and space. Well, let's talk about Ross, because he's the pony in the book, and he is an extraordinary being, very, very generous. And it's a huge privilege if you're in that space with them, because it's like you get a loan, you borrow, you get a loan of their senses. They're so attuned to the landscape, and they've got this brilliant hearing and just great awareness of what's going on. And, you know, if you're lucky, they let you pop into that space with them. And because they're non-verbal in the way that we speak, you tend to be quiet around them and listen. They're great teachers for listening, and more and more and more I want to be a listener and not a talker. And I'm very aware of the irony of that, because I'm aware that I've just not stopped talking. And in my life, more and more I'm sort of giving myself permission to be in a listening space, not a speaking space. And I'm enjoying that. And horses are the masters. They're the masters.
You made me want to go on that journey. It was so poetic. And I haven't had a chance to read your poetry, although I want to. Is it very much focused on nature and landscapes?
Well, my poetry is, yeah, it is. And actually, there are quite a lot of people in my poetry. And I think what I've done subconsciously, but looking back now, is I've addressed quite a few difficult things that I felt I couldn't address or speak directly about in my prose or in my normal life. I think now I see them very clearly in my poetry, which I hadn't when I was writing them. But looking back, they were like little arrows of, in the future, you might be able to talk about this thing, but for now, here's this reference in this poem. And I love poetry. It's you know, you have to cut down all the words, and I love that. So you have to, it's a wonderful, wonderful exercise in listening. You know, when I start a poem, there might be millions of, you know, words all over the page, and I have to listen to them and listen to them and get down to what really needs to be said. And I don't consider myself by any means to be a brilliant poet, but I love the process so much. It is a process of listening and paying attention.
Oh, I've never heard it talked about like a listening exercise. So thank you.
It's funny, Jen, but you know, I think probably I was a bit nervous, and I'm just aware that I've been talking a lot. And then the minute we got into the poetry and the horses, the poetry and the ponies, I can just feel my whole body soften and slow down, and my breathing change. And it's so interesting, isn't it? Things regulate us.
I think also I was expecting you to be on horseback and galloping along these islands, but actually from what you were saying in the book, and as I say, I'm not a horse rider, you're actually just walking with them, for a lot, like taking a big dog for a walk or something.
I think a lot of people really find that really hard to get their head around. Like, I've had so many people say, are you ever going to get on your horse? I do ride, and I really, really love riding. But if you're walking, riding all day long, it's actually just really nice to walk, and they're carrying the weight. So I don't have any, and then just hop on for half an hour to have a little rest and then get off again. And again, it's making sure power dynamics. Speaking of power dynamics, which we haven't touched on, but that's a really interesting one in the horse. I'm coming across it in my research in the deer world, as you know, all these different NGOs and land use, land managers and policymakers and residents and different power dynamics at play affecting what happens to the deer. And some of it is really uncomfortable, and I'd like to kind of dig in there if I've got the courage. But when I'm with my horse, I'm now ever increasingly aware of power and what power dynamics am I using? And am I being power over with my horse, or are we truly collaborating? And it's just a fascinating area. So I love like feeling like me and my horse are just hanging out and generally listening to each other and want the same thing. And it's not, you know, it sounds very romantic, and sometimes you just have to, come on, we're doing this even though you don't want to. There's a bit of that can happen, but more and more, you know, I don't want to get on my horse and whack it with a stick and tell him or her to do something they don't want to do. It doesn't fill my being with joy. But a conversation, yes, that fills my being with joy. And horses love moving through the landscape. They love it. They love going. You know, they're going without an expectation. They're just moving for the pure joy of it. And I love that. We can learn such a lot from them. And they're really having rests. You know, when the moment comes to have a rest, well, they make it very clear. And yeah.
One of the themes that also seemed to come up at the end of the book was after you'd had that kind of difficult moment through the terrain with the horse and meeting people there, there seemed to be you talking about actually taking up space and not worrying about what everybody else was thinking. And that's definitely something that's come to me, I think, through age as well. And is this something that you were feeling at the time? And has that been a process and a journey for you?
Hugely. Yeah. I mean, well spotted. It's a huge, I am still massively in process with that, you know, often imposter syndrome in this PhD environment, massive, but you can, you know, trace it back to that moment, in Kinloch Rissel, where we were basically stuck in very difficult terrain with the ponies. And my first thought was I shouldn't be here. And I was full of shame and worrying about what other people think. Shuna was so great in that moment. She's like, we've got enough to worry about. We really don't need to worry about what anyone else thinks. And yeah, that is often my first port of call. And like changing any patterns, it takes a lot of focus and attention and persistence and patience. Yeah. And of course, we have been brought up in a patriarchal society. And as women, is it safe to say that a lot of us know how to make ourselves smaller in certain situations or not feel as empowered as perhaps we could? So it's constant work in progress. Yeah,
and I also, going back to that way that we've been brought up, I found that at times it was quite confronting how messy your mum had been with her relationships and some of her life choices. And I was like, oh, it's so brave to talk about it. And then I'm like, well, why should it be? Like, that was clearly on me and my preconceptions. And it really made me question that story of women and how they behave. And so I thought that was really important for me to hear, and the way that you'd put the truth in there about your mum was so good for me.
I mean, you know, in mum's defense, not that she ever needed my defense, but she was always very open and honest. And she was brave in a way that I've never been brave. She really didn't mind telling people how it was. She was fierce, absolutely fierce. And she went for what she wanted. And she had a really difficult life. And it was filled with passion and adventure. Yeah, so I think I had an easy example, really, because she was very open and upfront and brave about her, who she was. She genuinely didn't appear to care what people thought. I mean, she would go out of her way to shock and wind people up.
Has it taken you time to appreciate these parts of her?
Yeah, really, really, really. Especially in view of the kind of emotional, personal messiness I found myself in. It gave me huge compassion of understanding how people find themselves in difficult emotional situations. So, I think I'm, like night and day. I am such, I like to think anyway that I'm not judgmental anymore. Sometimes it catches me and I just know it. I know that feeling when I'm being judgmental and I don't like it. And I'll have a little listen. I much prefer, it sits much better in the body, feeling compassionate and giving people the benefit of the doubt and understanding. I suppose forgiveness. and understanding that people are doing their best, and we all, by being alive, make messes. That's what we do. And it wouldn't be alive, would it, if we didn't have the odd mistake. What is a mistake? But life is not straightforward, and we're all doing our best, and it's complicated.
Yes, and if we go through life trying to avoid any mistakes, any confrontation, any difficulties, I mean, that doesn't sound like it's going to be a very adventurous or interesting life, does it?
No.
I found your book a book that was about resilience in so many ways. And I just wondered if you saw it like that and if you feel like you're a resilient person.
Well, I think I used to think of myself as a very resilient person. And, you know, all my life I've had people say, gosh, you just bounce back from things. Like, literally, the very last conversation with my stepfather, he actually said that to me. I'd come out of a relationship and I was heartbroken. And then very quickly I fell in love with Martin and was with Martin. It was like within weeks. And I was telling my stepfather, Paul, and he just said, you always land on your feet. And they were literally the last words he said to me. And I've just carried them. This is a big subject. Have I always felt I was resilient? I think I am resilient, and I've learned to make the most out of situations. But mom dying and the back surgery and the breakdown, all of those things showed me how fragile I was, actually. And the importance of recognizing fragility and vulnerability, and that resilience lies alongside that. And I suppose something that I'm thinking more and more about, as we all are, is the resilience of the natural world. We are in a really shit situation. We really, really are, with what's happening to the climate. And resilience resilience in the natural world is so important. And that's sitting alongside the recognition of how fragile things are. And I'm not quite sure if I'm making any sense there. I am resilient, and that sits alongside a great sense of fragility and vulnerability. And I suppose I'm linking that into the wider natural world that we're living in.
It does make sense to me, and it goes.
I am an optimist.
It goes back to that kind of definitions of resilience, and that hard, tough, rigid isn't really a resilience. And I love the softness and the recognizing the vulnerabilities, and going back when you said about the openness and compassion as being part of resilience, or that's how I took it anyway. And yes, that's something that both we need and the natural world. And how do you remain optimistic when we're presented with the evidence and that we are?
Yeah, it's a great question. How do I just do, but how do I? Because I love people, and I see people and I meet people who care so much and are tiny, tiny seeds of action have massive ripple effects. And yes, undoubtedly, we're in a colossal mess. But I really believe in the potential for humanity to get ourselves out of this. I believe in our capacity for love for each other, for all beings. I believe in our resilience, and I believe in our ability to change. So I suppose that's at the root of resilience, is how do we respond to change? Now, we have to change. We have to change. I think we're resourceful and resilient and wonderful in many, many ways. And we just need to tap into that.
Leonie, that feels such a beautiful place to end it on, our meandering conversation, slowly like the horses stopping for rest and getting distracted. Oh, but I am interested in what else you're up to. I feel like, did Mariam come out when it was like lockdown, or when did that come out? Have you done many events? Are you were you locked up and couldn't actually tour with this book? Or,
you know, I did quite a lot online, and then once restrictions were lifted, I feel really fortunate. I went to lots of events and we got out into the world.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we did, absolutely. It wasn't all online.
I wasn't sure about the timing.
So yeah. So it was, I mean, my book launch was literally cancelled the day before, because it was the day first lockdown started. But we made up for lost time afterwards. It's been a really fun journey.
That's great to hear. And what else have you got coming up? I know you're in your PhD now, but is there any other work that you can share, or ways that we can connect with you or come and see you or do something with your writings?
Well, I have a website. I was thinking about having a Substack, because I think that's probably a really good idea. Like, you've just ventured into that, haven't you?
I have. Well, actually, I've been doing it nearly a year now for me, and I do love it. And I think perhaps going back to that slowness and savoring, and I feel that for me the longer form on Substack works, because social media posts just go in a flash.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I'll have a look at that. But I do have a website, which is Leonie Charlton Writer, and some of my writing's on there. And there will be a book coming out called There She Goes, published by Saraband. I think next year it will come out. And that's on women travelling with a slightly different emphasis.
Oh, amazing. Well, I'll definitely have to speak to you again when that comes out, because that sounds fascinating.
And then hopefully there will be all sorts of deer-related fiction coming.
Is that still in the background? You haven't completely abandoned that?
Yeah, not at all. No, and I think it will be, my hope is through the PhD to give voice through fictional narratives. Because I think that might be the most effective way of doing it. You know, otherwise I love nonfiction, but you're very much worrying about so and so might recognize themselves, or whereas fiction, I think, will hopefully enable a more open and honest conversation.
It sounds
a less compromised one.
Yeah, it sounds amazing, and I can't wait for all that. But I'll put all the links in the show notes as well, so that people can find you, Leonie, and I hope I get to see you in real life now I'm moving up to Scotland too.
It's been such a joy talking.
It's been such a privilege.
And good luck with your, thanks, Jen, and good luck with your knee recovery.
Thank you so much. And thank you for being so open and honest and letting me ask you absolutely anything today. Thank you, Leonie. Thank you for listening to the Resilience Rising podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do help people find us by hitting subscribe, leaving a review, or sharing us with others. Thank you so much, and see you next time on the Resilience Rising podcast.